From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange on NHPR. The game of baseball has a way of piling pressure on those who play it. Imagine you're the batter. There are two outs and you are behind in the count, and you are the team's last hope for winning the game. Or imagine you're pitching, and you've got three runners on base and one last chance to end the inning. All you have to do is hit a spot more than 60 feet away. It's about the size of a sugar cube. Imagine the mental toughness it takes to push aside all your distracting thoughts and do what needs to be done. That mental toughness is the subject of former Major League pitcher Bob Tewksbury's new book. The Concord native spent 13 years in the majors and many years now as mental skills coach for both the Boston Red Sox and now San Francisco Giants. His new book is called 90% Mental. An all-star player turned mental skills coach reveals the hidden game of baseball. Bob Tewksbury, thank you very much for joining me.
Peter, it's great to be here. Listen often to this station and the programs that you have. So to be part of that today is pretty exciting.
This is super exciting for me as a baseball fan. I'm sure exciting for baseball fans out there as well. But this book has to do with not just an approach to baseball, but an approach to life, and we will get to that. But we do want to bring listener comments and questions in as well. So if you are interested in asking Bob a question about Major League Baseball, about his career, about how to keep your head in the game, so to speak, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. So, Bob, when we talk about the mental side of baseball, what are we talking about exactly?
Yeah, that's, you know, and that's an important question because people kind of take it for granted. Like, and even some of the players don't know what it is. So, you know, with there are three areas of performance when it comes to dealing with elite athletes or athletes at any level. There's physical, fundamental, and mental. Players often find it easy to work on the physical and fundamental side. The mental side is comprised of your thoughts, your actions, your feelings, goal setting, journaling, confidence, anxiety, learning how to breathe, properly using imagery as a tool to improve performance. So, you know, as you mentioned prior to coming on the show, we talked thoughts become things. And if players in those scenarios that you mentioned at the opening, if a player thinks that they're going to fail, they're probably going to fail. And so we try to, mental skills coaches really try to help the players think the right things at the right time so that they can give themselves the best chance to perform in that given moment.
So is a mental skills coach kind of like a therapist?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. There's a comparison to that for sure. I think, you know, we always in the field, we've always tried to figure out what's the best name, title for this position. You know, performance enhancement coach, mental skills coach, sports psychology coach. But it's like baseball counselor is essentially what I feel like I am because, you know, I've talked to the minor league players about breaking up with their girlfriends and players about boundaries with parents and coaches dealing with, you know, their own little drinking problems or being away from their family. And then performance of being on the field. So we do the same type of work. We're master's level certified, so I don't have a PhD. I can't call myself a psychologist, but I have a master's in sports psychology and counseling. So essentially, you're right. It is kind of like being a baseball therapist.
And it's easy to sort of imagine that ballplayers, especially when we see close-up shots of them on TV, that they just look so confident and in the moment and ready to perform. But they're human beings. They've got lives off the field, and it's easy for them to bring their lives off the field to the field, just like we could bring our lives outside of work into work.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a perception of, you know, fans see players in a certain way. They see them, you know, as players. It's like we look at actors, you know, Denzel Washington or Tom Hanks or whatever it is. We see them in character. It's like we know who they are, but they play that character. And I think athletes are the same way. We know them as the ball player, but we don't know them as the person. So I tell guys, baseball is what you do. It's not who you are. And that's what they do. And they have negative thoughts. They get anxious before games. They think they're never going to get another hit. Paul Molitor, the all-time ninth leading hit on the hit list, asked him one time, do you ever lose confidence? And he said, yeah, if I'm 0 for 12, not having any hits in 12 at-bats, I feel like I'm never going to get another hit. And that's Paul Molitor, Hall of Famer. So if he's having those thoughts, you know that everyone's having those thoughts.
Wow, so it takes some mental help, I guess, to get out of a slump like that. But let me ask you about what things were like for mental health in baseball when you started. You were drafted in 1981, and you started with the Yankees in 1986. What was professional baseball like back then with respect to mental health and mental skills coaching?
There was none. You know, it was something that I did a radio interview the other day in St. Louis, actually, and they mentioned that, and I could have used that being, you know, I'm from a small town in New Hampshire, Salisbury, New Hampshire, went to Merrimack Valley High School. You know, we had a couple hundred, maybe 2,000 people in our town, and I go to New York. I'm playing and living in, you know, New Jersey. I'm commuting over the George Washington Bridge. I'm playing in New York. I'm like, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, you know, like the Wizard of Oz. So it was really hard. It would have helped me a lot. But there were no teams that had those positions then. It slowly started in the late 80s, gained some traction probably in the late 90s. And since 2004 has gone to where we now have about 27 teams who have somebody providing this resource for the players.
So it's gaining in popularity now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason for that, Peter, is because, you know, the ownership, no one really, it's such a, you don't know if it helps players because it's not a tangible thing. You can see a guy that puts on 20 pounds and gets stronger. You can see a guy that changes his mechanics. You don't know if this helps, but it does. You know, you can't quantify it. And I think the teams are always like, why should I invest in something that I can't quite quantify? How do I know it's going to work? Well, now, as the field has grown and players are voicing how much this has helped, more teams are using this resource.
Yeah, well, you described a scene in this book, 90% Mental, where I believe you were at Portland Sea Dogs minor league game, and you were asking the players, how many among you think that your hang-ups have to do not with physical or fundamental things, but with mental issues?
Mm-hmm, right.
And how many hands raised?
Yeah, I asked them, I said, how many players here feel like they're playing up to their potential? None of them raised their hand. And I said, okay, under the three following categories, what is the reason why? I did physical, one guy raised his hand. Fundamental, one guy raised his hand. Mental, they all raised their hand. And then I said, what are you doing about it? And they all looked at me dumbfounded because they were like, oh my God. There's one thing to have the resource. It's another for the players to say, hey, I might be able to use this. And that's a gap that I constantly work to bridge with players now, in a very subtle way. It's not an easy job, really, because you're trying to help players that have already had a lot of past success. They make a lot of money. They have a lot of people telling them what to do, and I'm just another resource. So I have to kind of sit back and wait. In the minor leagues, I can be much more proactive, as I was that day with the Portland Sea Dogs. But in the big leagues, it's a little bit different.
Okay. We're talking with former major leaguer Bob Tewksbury, who's also a mental skills coach for the San Francisco Giants. He worked with the Boston Red Sox for a long time as well. What questions do you have about Major League Baseball, its mental aspect in particular, but also Bob's career? He spent 13 years in the majors. He's actually one of apparently, Bob, in your book, you wrote fewer than or around 2,000 people have spent more than a decade in the majors. So
right.
this is a pretty elite club, given how many people want to play professionally.
Yeah, of the 19,000 plus have ever played one day in the big leagues in 135 years, and less than 2,000 have played 10 years.
So quite an opportunity to ask a former major leaguer your question about baseball. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. For mental skills coaching in particular, you mentioned that it's different when you're working with rookies or people in the minor leagues versus the major leagues. It seems like for guys just starting out, it's more of a head game in a way, because you could, if you're good enough, you get to the majors, and then you get to the majors and they tell you, like they told you, you better perform or you're going back.
right.
That's a scary proposition, because the pressure is now on.
Right. Yeah. You know, there's the minor leaguers, they're so receptive to anything that they can do, because they're finally in professional baseball. They have this dream that's starting to come clear, but they also know how difficult it is, the hurdles of getting to the big league. So they'll try anything, and they're very open to that. Once they get to the big leagues, then, like you said, talent gets you to the big leagues. Mental skills and the ability to control the mental part of the game keeps you there, barring injury. And so the players have learned that through their minor league career, I think. They become professionalized, I call it, so that when they're in the big leagues, they know how to deal with things a little bit better. But still, there's times I've had great players ask me, you know, maybe one question all year, but maybe that one question helped them in some way.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your process of professionalization, because you write here that you were sent back to the minors 7 times, but ultimately you were able to stick it out and hang on to the major leagues. How did you end up doing that?
Yeah, as they say, and it was that officer and a gentleman, I got no place else to go. I had no place else to go. I've got to do this. But I think that, you know, perseverance, I worked hard. I had 2 surgeries also. One was a major shoulder surgery. Just constant belief, constant work. I mean, there are times where I'm sure I doubted the ability to come back and play. But after my shoulder got healthy and I had some success, you know, in St. Louis mainly, that's when things took off. And, you know, over that 3-year period in St. Louis, I pitched really well. And, you know, I think, you know, the question is, it's kind of creating a lot of uncertainty in me. I'm not sure why. I think it's a great question, because it's resilience, determination, perseverance. It's all those things, grit. It's all those things that people that have to go through to be successful, no matter what your domain is, no matter your vocation. And people don't see those struggles. They see the end result, but they don't see the path that you go on to get there.
Mm-hmm. You write a bit about using things like anchor statements and being super conscious of what you say is thoughts become things. As you were developing the habit of being a major leaguer, did you employ some of those things yourself, anchor statements and just keeping track of your thoughts?
That's where I came up with it in a book. I kept really detailed journals of when I pitched for several years. And I would write down, my anchor statement was just like on the side. And what that means is, when you throw a bullpen, starting pitchers throw a bullpen day. It's called a side day in between starts. And those days are free and easy. There's no umpire. There's no judgment. There's no consequences. You're relaxed. So by saying that, just like on the side, my body understood what that meant. And so when I got into situations, I would relax myself by saying that. And other players that I've worked with say, you know, soft and easy, you know, easy and effortless. So it's like a mantra. It's like a word. I call them anchor statements as it relates to performance. But I still use them. You know, where am I? What am I doing? You know, I mean, we all have a lot going on, and I think we need to remember to be where your feet are is another one, to remember where you are and be there.
Mm-hmm. What kind of advice did you get from fellow major leaguers when you were coming up?
Don't make the manager mad. I had Ron, Rick Roden and Joe Niekro were guys in New York when I was there, Ron Guidry, some older guys. They basically, back then, they just told you to keep your mouth shut and do your job. And it's a lot more open and welcoming now. Players, you know, will give you tidbits here and there. But back then, it was just be quiet and do your job.
Huh. It's not something you would advocate for now.
No. I think that now you kind of put your arm around them and say, hey, look, this is going to be a challenge for you. But that's where the game has changed, and that's where the perception of the old school versus new school is kind of butted, because there are still a lot of old school staff members that think rookies and new players should just shut up and do your job. But they're also part of the team and they should be treated that way.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, give us a call if you have a question, 1-800-892-6477, or shoot us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. So how did your ability to stay focused change over your 13 years in the majors?
I think that it became more focused on the task of making this pitch than it did on the consequences of not making it. For example, in New York, I was always afraid I was going to get sent down if I had a bad game. So I was worried about the outcome and not the task. And as I got more confident, more comfortable, I became more focused on the task. Broke down each game into one inning, you know, win this inning, get the leadoff hitter out, you know, get the leadoff hitter out, throw a first pitch strike. So my focus became from a larger survival mode to just doing what I needed to do at that moment.
Yeah. Tell us about your near perfect game. This is an incredible story. We'd love to hear about it.
Yeah. Which part would you like to hear first?
Well, it started off as a normal game.
It was a quiet Sunday afternoon. And it was 1990. I had just pitched a shutout against the Pirates. I was still trying to establish myself as a major league player. And my wife was in town, and she was visiting from New Hampshire, and Laura came in, and I just went out and pitched and was coming off a very successful outing, was confident. And then, you know, it was three up, three down. There was one play that Terry Pendleton made at third base that was a nice play, but nothing spectacular. And then get to the seventh inning and crowd's starting to get into it. And then I'm starting to think about it because I know what's going on. And Laura later tells me that she had an iced tea. It was a night game.
Yeah.
Laura, my wife, had an iced tea, and she had to go to the bathroom, and she was afraid to leave because she knew about the jinx. So anyway, I talked with Todd Zeal. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to throw here, this first pitch. What do you think we should throw? Franklin Stubbs was the hitter.
Oh.
And I said, let's go with fastball away, and I threw it fastball away, and he had a soft looper to left field that fell in for their only hit and only base runner. And it's interesting because I talk about that in the book, as you said, but I was a little relieved, more relieved than angry, because it was the pressure of that mounting to that moment. I don't know how I would have handled that. And I was just happy that I pitched another good game, so I was staying in the big leagues. But later on, I dissected that pitch for months, thinking about why didn't I throw that, second guessing of how could I not have been perfect, which we get into talking about that in the book. But it was a great moment. But yeah, we Franklin has a middle name that we can't say on the air, but Franklin Stubbs was the guy.
Yeah. So, but we still remember that day in 1990 as a one hitter, which is not a small accomplishment. So we're speaking with former major leaguer and mental skills coach Bob Tewksbury. Concord Resident is out with a new book, 90% Mental, which reveals the hidden mental side of baseball. What questions do you have about baseball, its mental side, or anything else that someone who spent 13 years in the major leagues would know about? Now's your chance to ask the question that you want answered. You can send it by email to exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Yeah, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoi, and we are speaking today with Bob Tewksbury, who pitched in the majors from 1986 to 1998 for six different major league teams. He then went on to serve as mental skills coach for the Boston Red Sox and now serves in that capacity for the San Francisco Giants. His new book is called 90% Mental. An all-star player turned mental skills coach reveals the hidden game of baseball. And we're happy to take your questions and calls. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We got an emailed question from Bill, who wanted to know, Bob, we see players talking to opponents while they're on base. Are these conversations friendly banter or an opportunity to sort of chide or jive with the other guy? It looks friendly and funny most of the time, but is it?
Yeah, it is now, and it's something you talk about. I appreciate the question. Old school guys would never talk to the opposing player. You'd run in different directions. When I came up, you ran toward the outfield. You never ran to the middle of the field where you might run into an opposing player. That bothers a lot of old-timers now, coaching. Players are out there talking before the game and hugging everybody. So it's usually somebody that they if they're a Latin American player, they played together with them in winter ball. They may have played together in the fall league. Somehow they're connected. So, it's all cordial. It's fun. But it's something that some people don't like.
Okay, so not trying to play mental games with each other while they're on base. They're
just catching up. No, they're just,
Okay. Let's go to Yvonne in North Sutton. Yvonne, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I am a huge Red Sox fan, and I'm wondering if the difference this year is mental attitude more than skills, which they already had.
Hi, I appreciate the question. I think it's residual effects from my being there for 15 years is really what I think it is. They have a great mental skills coach there, Laz Gutierrez, and I think that they're, to your point, I think they do have a, from what I've heard, they do have a pretty relaxed atmosphere. Joey Cora's done a great job with his staff. Dana Lavangie's been a longtime bullpen guy. He's very, very smart. I'm glad he's the pitching coach. He's very... I'm glad he's in that position because he's more than a bullpen coach. So I think, culture and chemistry does come into play. They are different. John had a different style of managing and connecting with the players. And I think you're seeing the Latin players and young players really feel more comfortable around the staff that they have. And I think Cora could be responsible for that.
Mm-hmm. And we got a call from Dan in Concord. Dan, thanks for calling.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for the opportunity. I was curious about what elite athletes go through when they're injured or they've had surgery for a long time. How is it different from, is it different from just normally having to be resolute and determined to get back? And do you encounter, do you do counseling with athletes who are injured and wondering whether they're ever going to make it back, what they need to do?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. That is, when you're injured on the team, you feel like you have a scarlet letter on your head, loser, big L, because you feel like you're not part of the team and you feel like your teammates, you kind of project that out. You feel like your teammates see you in that way. And what I tell the players that are injured is, when you were playing, did you look at the injured player that way? And they said, no. And I said, why? He said, because I have my own stuff going on. And I said, well, that's the same thing now. They're not worried that you're injured, that you're but what you need to do is focus on getting better. And the anxiety that comes from players that are trying to come back, depending on the significance of the injury, is real. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of trepidation. There's hurdles that they have to go through over time. And I think that I tell players that are injured, there's three types of time. There's baseball time, time on the clock, and then there's God's time. And God's time will determine when you come back. It's you can't rush things. And the players are really impatient because, A, they don't like being hurt and not being part of the team. B, they're afraid they're going to lose their job. And that means a lot of money in some cases. So all of those things are a full spectrum for the injured player.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Rich in Concord. Rich, thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. And Bob, my wife very much enjoys doing jazzercise with Laura.
Oh, Laura's there now. Thank you, Rich.
My question is, I'm a little older now, but I've done long distance running in my life. I've even was on a track team with a couple folks that made it to the Olympics. The thing that I find is that I can get excited about seeing myself improve for a while, you know, a year or two, but then it's like, how do you stay at such a high level or work past just getting bored, or, you know, it's the same thing and you may not see the improvement there for a while. And that's where I find I lose it and get more disinterested and maybe not meet my goals.
Well, motivation is, you know, as you get older, it becomes difficult to sustain that level of ability. I think resetting, you know, I would say the quick thing would be to reset your goals so that become more, I don't know if they're more realistic, but goals help motivation, and motivation is what you need, it sounds like, when you get bored with what's going on. As we age as athletes, you know, we're not going to be able to perform the same way we once did, but our mind is always the, you know, 20-year-old athlete and thinks we can do anything. And that's why people at my age, you know, get injured playing Thanksgiving Day football or pick up basketball, is because our bodies aren't used to taking that. But so the quick part of that, and I'm not sure if I'm answering your question correctly, but, you know, resetting goals, finding new motivation, and maybe having a different expectation of what you feel like you should be doing versus what you really can do.
Lots of great questions from listeners, and we welcome more if you've got them. The phone number to call, 1-800-892-6477. We've been talking a little bit this morning about statements that sort of recenter you mentally for the game. We've talked about thoughts becoming things. And we got this question from Wendy, who asked, Bob, do your techniques work for sports other than baseball, or are they baseball specific?
They're for any athlete. They're for any person, any athlete. I think I've had a granddad for a lacrosse player at the University of Virginia email me and say, will this book help my daughter, even though it's baseball? And absolutely, because the reason is I talk about the aspects related to performance that you can put under any team or any individual sport or team sport: concentration, confidence, using breathing as a tool, using imagery as a tool. So those are all things that can be applied to other sports. Yeah, absolutely.
We got a question from Greg in Salisbury. Bob, how do you feel about the pressure that is put on kids to focus on a particular sport? And then a follow-up question, did you play more than one sport at Merrimack Valley High School?
I did. I played basketball. I played soccer for a little bit, but basketball and baseball mostly. I don't like the pressure that's being applied to children now. I understand, you know, the AAU programs all the way through are the programs that, you know, they're not going to go away, I think. But I think players, athletes, young athletes need to sample different sports. They shouldn't specialize until they become late teens, maybe their last year in high school if they have a career past that. You know, I think one of the things that I read the other day that a certain percentage of the first picks in the NFL draft were multiple sport athletes. Colleges and teams look for the athletes now that play multiple sports because of such things like burnout and overuse, especially with pitchers, AAU pitchers. Those guys that log a lot of innings and as their youth and through college are the ones that are more susceptible to Tommy John injuries, which are starting to happen earlier and earlier. So I think there's a whole thing on education of the parents about why do they play specialized sport, what's the end result. And not only is it cost, but it's also cost and time for the family, but it also does put pressure on the kids.
We've got a call from Bill in Ware. Bill, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Bob. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Hi, Bill.
And I'm curious if a pitcher looking back on a finished career with a wall full of awards and accolades, how he'd rank a World Series ring, a Cy Young, or a perfect game.
Wow.
If you had to choose,
I would take a World Series ring. Yeah, because that's a team, you know, that's a team accomplishment. The signing award's great, but, you know, I have three World Series rings, 04, 07. So the 04 one's really special. They gave them to the organization. I was working with the Red Sox, of course. 07, I was in the minor leagues working with the Red Sox, and that's where I met guys like Papon, Pedroia, Ellsbury, Lester. And then in 13, I was working as the mental skills coach at the big league level in AAA. So that ring feels like I have a little bit of ownership in that ring, but I have no player ring. And this is a great question because Sean Dunstan and I, the former great Cub shortstop, is now the video guy for the Giants. And he doesn't have a World Series ring as a player. And in 2007, when the Angels, we were just in Anaheim, when the Angels beat them, he said, that Game 7 loss was the worst day of my life. I would trade all three rings I have as a coach for that one ring as a player.
Wow.
So World Series ring, Bill.
Well, you played in the playoffs, right? I think it was with when you were with the Padres against the Dodgers.
Padres, well, we beat the Dodgers the last day of the season to win the Western Division, and that was kind of like a playoff game for me because I pitched that game, and then we lost to the Cardinals in the next round.
Oh, okay.
So that was my extent of my postseason. I never pitched in the postseason, but that Dodger game, I feel, was a postseason game for me.
Mm-hmm. You read about feeling like there were millions of eyes watching you on television.
I loved it.
You loved it? Okay.
I loved it. It was great.
I was going to say, how did you manage to get through the pressure of that? But it seems like it's pretty easy.
I was so excited with the chance to pitch. I wanted the ball. And even now, I mean, those situations I watch on TV in the postseason, I tell Laura, I wish I was pitching today. I wish I was pitching today. And the opening day in L.A., you know, I remember we got introduced and I was standing on the foul line and I told the guy next to me, I wish I was pitching today. So you get that fire in the belly that just to go out and compete, that's what I miss. And that fire is still there.
Yeah. Do different crowds have a different effect on your state, a mental state when you're on the mound?
Yeah, they do. I think, you know, the Dodger crowd is much more laid back than if you were at Yankee Stadium or even Fenway. I think one of the most overwhelming times I had as a player was as an opposing player playing for the Rangers. I was pitching against the Red Sox, and 35,000 people I didn't know could sound so loud. But it's the passion, it's the enthusiasm that the Boston, New England fans bring, and that sounded a lot louder than 50,000 people at you know, at another ballpark.
Wow. Tell us about your appearance in the All-Star game, because it started off great and then something happened to your mental state, and I think it's part of what we're talking about here with this book, 90% Mental, is making sure that you're always in a good mental place while you're on the mound. Tell us about your All-Star appearance.
Yeah. So I came in, Tom Glavin started, gave up 6 runs in the first inning. I'm in the bullpen going, wow, well, I surely can't do as bad as that. So the pressure's off. He got knocked out. I get called in, I think, in the 4th or 5th inning. I faced 3 hitters, McGuire, Joe Carter, and Cal Ripken, one Hall of Famer and 2 borderline.
Clarify, like, you expected to pitch 1 inning.
1 inning, yeah. So when you come into the All-Star game, unless you're the starting pitcher who usually pitches 2 innings, everyone else goes 1 inning. So you're right, Peter. So I thought I was done. I walk off the field. I'm like, yeah, an inning scoreless in a game. People are watching, friends and family back home. This is good. I'm in the dugout, take a breath, kind of digging myself a little bit, you know, like, whew, that was pretty cool. And Bobby Cox comes up to me. He's the manager of the All-Star team and says, hey, Tukes, how do you feel? I'm like, fine. He goes, good, you get another inning. And I was like, oh, God. And that moment right there, it surprised me. And it set in tone, thoughts become things, because I was like, I don't want to go back out there. What if I might give up a run? And what if I don't do well? I've already had a scoreless inning. All these thoughts started rambling through my head. And so I went out, and I went back to my anchor statements. First pitch strike, get the leadoff hitter out, breathe. So I had 2 outs and a guy on second, and hadn't given up a run, and I gave up 4 runs. And after the second run came in, I remember being on the mound feeling embarrassed, feeling like I shouldn't be out there. Why did he put me out here? I was feeling sorry for myself. And they removed me. I walked Travis Fryman, and they came and took me out. And so I set myself up for that by what I was thinking in between innings. And I learned that you never turn off that mental edge until you're told to turn it off. And I think that, you know, that's certainly a transferable skill or something that people can think about is to, you know, when you think it's over, it may not be over. So don't let up. Don't let up. Don't give up. And that let up cost me 4 runs in an All-Star game.
And how did you process thoughts about your performance that day after the game?
I got down on myself. Probably I was harder on myself than I should have been, I think, for a while. But my wife was there. Griffin, my son, was a couple of years old. My best friend and his wife were there. I just pitched in an All-Star game. You know, lots of people, you know, not a lot of people get to pitch in an All-Star game.
That's an understatement.
And I was 9-3, so I was having a good season. So I just kind of flushed it and went out to pitching. But it definitely stung for a little bit, for sure.
But you get over it, and you feel pretty good about your All-Star appearance now.
Yeah,
yes?
And I won 16 games that year, so things were okay.
That was 1992, right?
92.
Good season, yeah.
Yep.
And you, I mean, wasn't the time you threw the Ephus pitch to Mark McGwire?
No,
was
that
it?
Was in 98.
So just maybe I'm describing this right, but the Ephus pitch is like this arching, slow pitch that looks kind of like a watermelon, but kind of isn't, right? Like,
yeah.
hitters like really want to hit it, but they can't. And you decided to throw this to Mark McGwire really quickly. Can you tell us about that?
It's a 47-mile-an-hour curveball. My son nicknamed the Dominator, and it has forward spin. It's not like a lob pitch, so a curveball has forward spin. So it's thrown like a curveball, and it arches in. And I threw it to McGwire to offset his timing. And he almost, you know, like the Bugs Bunny cartoon, he almost swung twice at it, and he popped it up, and he was laughing on the way down to first base. It was really a highlight. They showed that on MLB Network a couple of weeks ago when I was on, and I was like, oh, my God, the ball goes out of the screen of the TV set and back in. So it was fun.
Yeah, those pictures are amazing. I actually tried to find a clip of that on YouTube, and I wasn't able to, but I can't imagine what the announcers had to say about that pitch. Listeners, we're speaking with former major leaguer Bob Tewksbury about his new book, 90% Mental, an all-star player turned mental skills coach reveals the hidden game of baseball. We're also speaking about baseball in general and his career and his approach and how he works with players. If you have questions about the game, about his career, about how to keep your head in the game, both in terms of baseball and in terms of life, because this applies to life too, after all, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Thank you very much for sending your questions so far. Now's a chance to ask your burning baseball questions. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and we are speaking today with Bob Tewksbury, who pitched in the majors for 13 years for 6 different major league teams, and then he went on to serve as a mental skills coach for the Boston Red Sox, now serves in that capacity for the San Francisco Giants. His new book is called 90% Mental, an all-star player turned mental skills coach reveals the hidden game of baseball. Call now with your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. We got an email from David and Meredith, who was asking, my son and I wondered, what is happening when a skilled and talented pitcher who pitches extremely well suddenly has a game when he struggles to get the ball over the plate? Is this a mental issue or a mechanical issue, or a mechanical issue that has a mental impact? How does a pitcher and staff address this during the game? So a lot of questions there, mostly related from David and Meredith. What do you think, Bob?
Yeah, that's thanks for the question, Dave. I think that it could be both. Sometimes it's a mechanical issue. It's a flaw that a pitcher may have something that he's doing that he can't quite correct. So the dialogue in that case would be the role of the pitching coach saying, hey, you've got to keep your body closed, or you've got to drive, you know, stay back over the rubber more. So the thought process would go with the pitcher. If he's not throwing strikes, what am I doing wrong? How come I can't throw the ball over? I don't want to keep walking these guys. Coach is going to get mad. Then I'm going to have to throw a pitch down the middle to this hitter. I'm going to give up runs. That's their narrative. So if it's a mechanical thing in the guy's experience, what am I doing wrong? Okay, I can correct this, make an adjustment, and then things go into play. If it's a mental thing to start with, lack of confidence, you know, sometimes this happens when the first guy that they face reaches base, and now they get anxious about, oh my God, I got to pitch with a guy on first. And then so it becomes a mental. So both of those cycles happen. I think the goal of the pitching coach is to identify mechanical issues. And oftentimes the players won't, their internal narrative is different than their external narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't tell a pitching coach that, hey, I'm afraid today. I have no confidence. I think I'm going to, you know, really stink. He's never going to say that. But if a player has anchors, and that's where a case where I would help them develop anchors, breathing routines, things that would help them regain focus so that he changes that narrative and then he goes on and pitches.
It's astounding how much power a mental block can have. You write in this book about one pitcher, and I forget his name, who just all of a sudden couldn't find the strike zone, like not even close, and it ruined his career, right? Do you remember who I'm speaking about?
Well, Steve Blass had
it.
Rick Ankiel. Well, I mean, there's been a few. Yeah, the throwing issues that, quote unquote, yips. I don't know if that's a great term for it, but people, throwing athletes, baseball players, softball players, sometimes get in this funk where they just can't throw. It's like their hand is somebody else's hand, and that's something that I've actually talking with a couple of players about now. That have that. It's really a tough thing to overcome, but not really sure the orientation of it. There's no quick fix to it, but it's certainly an area that mental skills people can help deal with the anxiety and the frustration of that.
I remember you also wrote about Chuck Knobloch, right, the second baseman, and I remember watching him in the late 90s. I think he was playing for the Yankees at the time. Second base, very close to first base for those of you who aren't baseball fans. And it's a short throw, relatively speaking. He kept missing these throws.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, like, why is he missing these throws? This is like a little league thing. But maybe it was a mental block.
Oh, it was. Definitely. That's why he went to the outfield because of that, because he couldn't throw that. So there is a mental block there. Unlocking that is proven to be difficult.
Yeah. So you, as a pitcher, you weren't known for your speed, not necessarily, but you were known for your accuracy, and you could pretty reliably put a ball wherever you wanted it. Why was that important for you?
Because I didn't throw hard. You know, right now, if you throw 95 to 98, you can afford to make mistakes over the plate, we'll say, because you're faster than the hitter's response. I threw in the hitting speed. So in order for me to have success, I had to be able to pinpoint my pitches with accuracy, which started back to my childhood in Salisbury, throwing balls against the schoolyard wall at Salisbury Elementary School. You know, I've always working on throwing at targets because I had to. That's how I survived.
Yeah, practice to find the plate and to have a few reliable pitches.
Yeah.
There's one scene in this book I absolutely loved. I think you were working with a minor league team and you asked the pitchers, how many pitches do you have?
Yeah.
And someone raised his hand and said four.
Four.
Maybe it wasn't you. It was someone else that this team was working with.
No, it was. I was.
That was you?
I was when I was a player.
That was when you were a player.
And
okay.
And Ted Simmons, the coach, asked a pitcher. We were doing a discussion on pitching, and the pitcher said he had four pitches. And he goes, really? And he goes, if you can get up and throw, you know, 7 out of 10 pitches over the plate, we'll consider that a pitch. We'll put it in your back pocket.
Hmm.
So needless to say, the guy didn't throw his fastball over the plate 7 out of 10 times. So, but he had 4 pitches. And so that's where it gets back to my command. I could command my fastball, which made my other pitches better.
Yeah. You wrote, there's a passage here that I really want to quote because it seems to summarize how important it is to have conviction, but also a good cadre of pitches in your back pocket. So you write, a filthy fastball can make things easier because it allows a pitcher to miss spots and still get people out. But it's a two-part approach. The physical part is step two in the process. Step one happens upstairs before a pitcher winds up to throw the ball. He must determine what pitch he's going to throw next and to which location to the plate. And once that part is finalized, the conviction must be there to throw it. Only then, when the conviction is forged in steely resolve, are the physical odds of throwing a strike to the desired location greatly increased. Conviction plus execution.
Yeah. Hey, that's pretty cool. You read that really well. I should have had you read the audio for me. Well, I think, you know, we have a saying, the ball knows. When you throw a pitch with conviction, it seems like the ball knows because you could make a bad pitch and get hitters out. When you throw a ball with timidity and fear, those are the ones that get hit. It's like the ball knows. So you have to be able to have conviction in your pitches. You have to trust your first thought, and that takes preparation. You know, you have to know what you're doing. I think now we could get into this whole other subject about analytics and pitch counts and all that stuff, but players today have so much information given to them that they often don't understand why. And I think understanding the why that you're going to throw a certain pitch is really important, and it helps with the conviction.
Mm-hmm. Especially because you can sort of imagine that a hitter is trying to predict what you're going to throw next. And I read somewhere years ago that Mark McGwire sort of could predict it with 85% accuracy, and that was why he was so good as a hitter.
Sure.
So as a pitcher, you sort of have to play this, what you call a cat and mouse game.
Yeah.
He knows that I know that you know that he knows what you're going to throw next.
Right.
So how do you predict it? We've got a call from Stefan. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Stefan in Goffstown. Thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm going to ask you about probably the a guy that really sticks out in my mind where he had a mental lapse was Yankee great Chuck Knoblauch, second baseman. How could a coaching staff let a player that had such problems throwing to first base continue? It obviously wasn't a physical thing because he was able to do that for years before, and then all of a sudden, like a fog rolling in, he just couldn't do it anymore. So how does a coaching staff allow that to continue and not just pull him and then work on his confidence or his mental state?
Well, I'm not sure what the Yankees, reasons for that were, but I would say initially you're paying him a lot of money. So that's not a reason, but it is in the big leagues. You're paying this guy, you expect him to go out. You think it might go away if you just keep playing him. If you put him on the disabled list, and then you have to bring somebody else up, you know, does that help him or does that hurt him? I think the whole issue with the inability to throw is so complicated that no one really knows how to do it. You know, Rick Ankiel couldn't pitch, so he went to the outfield. Chuck Knoblauch actually went to the outfield. So why the Yankees? Sounds like Stefan's a big Yankee fan. Why the Yankees continue to let that happen? I have no idea. Maybe for the entertainment of the fans.
The schadenfreude of the fans who want to see him fail. I don't know. I wanted to ask about the need for mental coaching on an individual basis. Do all players need some level of it, or are some players just born with the ability to focus and tune things out and they just don't have any need for this at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think everyone can benefit from something. Finding out, I think some players could use more than others, but there are players, you know, the great players have a way of figuring things out. You know, Michael Jordan wasn't afraid to take the last shot because he didn't fear the consequences, but Michael might have used help with his breathing at the foul line, something like that. David Ortiz was great in the clutch. You know, he always played well in the clutch. And as he got older, he had to change his approach to do different things. So I think there's a big part of it that is innate, but I think we can all benefit from a tune-up now and then.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the work you did with Anthony Rizzo. He was a member of the Chicago Cubs World Series team in 2016, but you worked with him since he was a teenager. Tell us about how you worked with him.
Yeah, Riz was a I remember when we first signed him, I knew he was a big leaguer when I saw him, and not surprised he's had the success. It's funny because I gave him a copy of the book in spring training, and I saw him a couple days later, and he gave him a big hug, and he goes, "Man, I forgot," because the chapter's titled Putting on the Riz. And he goes, "I forgot I was even in the book." So we made an audio program that would be, it's like an imagery program where he would listen to and imagine himself hitting. There were some positive anchors in there, confidence statements. So it was kind of like a self-help audio, if you will.
You recorded statements
that
for him?
I made for him, yeah.
We got a question from Jim, who said, first, Bob has done great things fundraising for the Concord Boys and Girls Club. Just to pause on that, you painted, right? You painted
a lithograph,
yeah, and then you sold them at auction and split them up between Boys and Girls Clubs here and then
in St. Louis, Seattle, and Concord. Yeah.
Okay, so that's what Jim is talking about there. And then Jim also asks, question: can youth and high school coaches diagnose these types of problems in several sports? And if so, are there specific ways to help fix?
I'm not sure what is he talking about. Throwing problem? I'm not sure what problem he's talking about.
I think
about.
He's referring to just mental blocks in general.
Yeah. I think implementing some type of focus on the mental skills would be one way to find out. You know, if the coaches were able to, you know, attend a workshop or read about it and make their own, you know, presentation on, you know, breathing, self-talk, goal setting, they could, you know, there's a lot of resources where they could kind of create their own curriculum and make that part of their routine. I think that the feedback that they would get from the players would be incredible.
Mm-hmm. Should coaches at the high school level or even at the little league level pay attention to the mental health of their players?
Well, mental health and mental skills.
Mental skills.
So I think that, yeah, I think the big thing is always that at a certain age, it's all confidence. And I think the coaches understanding what helps a player, what confidence is, how players feel, you know, to not keep putting the same guy in right field because you think he's not the best player, especially at a youth level. Move him around. Give him some confidence. So I think there's a lot of good coaching books out there. There's a great website, positivecoaching.org, Jim Thompson put together. It's great information. I think the more the coaches can get information on all aspects of performance, regardless of their sport, they'll be better coaches.
I had a question about implementing the pitch clock in Major League Baseball. It's not happened yet as far as I know, right? But it's in the minors in
some
areas?
Yeah, it's in the minor leagues.
Do you think this has an effect at all on the pitcher's game?
No. I think it's a detriment because the players, they'll pay the fine. They're not going to be worried about throwing a pitch at a certain time frame. So think about the golfers out there or even the pro. Imagine the pro golfer in a tournament having 30 seconds to make the putt. What, you know, I mean, golf is tedious when the players are on the green. So I think that there's a natural rhythm to the game. Players have always said, if you want to speed the game up, you know, cut out the commercials. You know, the walk-up songs could be eliminated. I'm not a big walk-up song guy. But some of it is because the players are better. There's a lot more foul balls. You know, there's but 3 minutes between innings or the instant replay. You know, so that cuts into time, too. So of all the things that they can do to speed it up, the pitch clock is not the one I think would do it.
Are you not a fan of instant replay?
No.
Why not?
I think that there's something to be learned in baseball and in life that things aren't always perfect. Things don't always work out. Bad calls go against you. Bad things happen at a bad time. And I think that the instant replay and all its fairness creates it kind of neuters the game a little bit with it. You know, there's no fire. You know, the play at second. I don't like the second base play where runners can't take out the shortstop. And it was made for a reason that was the shortstop turned the wrong way. And that's why Chase Utley hit him in the playoffs. I can see the slide into home, not bowling the catcher over. But I think, you know, things happen. And why do we always have to get it right? I think that's part of that's what sport teaches us. And now we're so conditioned, like, oh, look at the replay. Oh, they got it right. Oh, everything's fair. Life isn't fair, so why should baseball be?
Yeah, I remember back in the 90s, we would see instant replay on TV, the umpires wouldn't look at it. And that the announcers would be so careful to not really second guess the umpire. But now it seems like they do a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's easy for them because they're going to get the right answer. And most of the time, the umpires are right. But yeah, I'm not a big fan of the instant replay.
So, Bob, as you look back on your career as a player, is there anything you wish you had done differently with respect to bringing your head into the game?
I don't think so. I wish there was a resource that I could have used. But for myself, I love baseball. I mean, that's what I wanted to do since I was a kid. I used to chart the game of the weeks in high school, Tony Kubek and Joe Garagiola. I used to chart them. I used to keep journals. I used to read books. I still have a book checked out from the Merrimack Valley Library on Bob Schar's pitching. I hope no one from the library is listening.
But
there's nothing else I would do. I think staying healthy would have been more fun. But I had my path, and my path is pretty good. I wouldn't change it.
Well, Bob Tewksbury, thank you very much for coming to The Exchange and speaking about your new book.
Peter, thanks for having me on. It's wonderful. And thanks for all the call-ins and the email questions.
The book is called 90% Mental, an all-star player turned mental skills coach reveals the hidden game of baseball. Bob is from Concord, and he says that there are signed copies of this book at Concord's Gibson's bookstore, right?
Yes.
You recently appeared there. It was a pretty good turnout.
Or they can order it there, yeah.
Okay. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And remember, the conversation continues at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. The engineer of The Exchange is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.